This episode of the 602 Club is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise and Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseandspace.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Welcome, everyone, to Trek FM's local watering hole, where the hosts from the network and friends will just drop by to talk all things geeky, so order a drink from Ruby and grab a chair. I'm your host, Matthew Rushing, and joining me today are Andy. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm good.
Glad to have you here, and as I think people probably know now from the network, you are brand new to Trek.
First time Trek.
Yes, that's right. First time Trek. In fact, a first time Trekker on Twitter, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
Awesome. So everybody should be following you there as you get to know Star Trek. I enjoy following you with your live tweets, and it's a lot of fun. So, and then Norm, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Glad to be in the 602.
Awesome. I don't know if maybe we should start asking what people are drinking, this is the 602 Club. Anybody drinking anything interesting this evening?
Tarkalian tea.
Excellent.
Blood wine.
Blood wine. Nice. I've just got a cup of Joe in my NX-01 mug here. I didn't want to be too inebriated for our special show tonight.
Joe or Ractigino?
Well, I just went with normal coffee. Ruby makes the best coffee on the West Coast, so it's, yeah, really enjoying it. Plus, like I said, it's in this nice Enterprise mug.
Oh, very nice.
The NX-01. So she keeps a special batch of these down here. I think Archer gave them to her as a gift. So anyway. Well, tonight, as you guys know, with the 602, we just pick out a geeky topic and we talk about it. And tonight, we're going to be talking about the Madman with a Box, the one and the only Doctor Who. And so I'm excited to have you guys talk about that with me. I'm kind of a new convert myself, but I'm interested first to hear how y'all got into Doctor Who. So, Andy, tell us how you found the Good Doctor.
Oh, goodness. I'm also, I guess, in the scope of things, a latecomer to Doctor Who. I wasn't aware of the classic series at all. It was only a couple seasons into the reboot that I started hearing about it. I lived overseas in China and worked with some Australians, and it's huge in Australia. It hadn't quite hit the U.S. nearly as hard at that point. And all I would hear from my Australian friends was Doctor Who, Doctor Who, Doctor Who. So started watching it, and I actually watched the pilot and hated it. I hated Rose, the episode, not the companion, and vowed to never watch it again. And then a year later, I was like, maybe I should give it another chance, and got to the second episode and never looked back. So started watching it religiously, went back and watched a lot of the classic Who, and really loved that as well. So yeah, I mean, not so long, only it feels like a lot of like a lifetime obsession, but it's only been the last 4 or 5 years.
That's a lot of fun. How about you, Norm?
Oh, that makes me feel so old. I started watching Doctor Who on PBS, my local public broadcasting station when I used to live in Ohio when I was around 5 years old, 6 years old. And they still played it in the four-part broken, the four-part episode series.
Yeah.
And I started watching with John Pertwee.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure when I was that age, they were probably rerunning at the time. But then I got into the Tom Baker years, starting with Robot. And the Tom Baker years were probably my most formative years of being a Doctor Who fan. But I've watched it all the way through the you know, through Peter, through Colin, through Sylvester, through the short-lived, Peter McGann and Paul McGann, and then Christopher Eccleston, and then bam, it was. I pretty much loved it where he said "Run for your life," and ever since then, you know, moving forward. But I've loved every kind of flavor of him, and he's been really entertaining all these years. And you know, he's a nice breath of fresh air, you know, versus all the star this and star that. And as much as I love those, so
I think a lot of American Doctor Who fans got into it through PBS. I've heard that a lot, especially the Tom Baker years were rerun on PBS a lot. I just, for whatever reason, missed it. But I've heard a lot of people talk about that, and I don't think you're alone there at all.
Well, I mean, he had the greatest wealth of episodes. I mean, he ran, 7 years?
Mm-hmm.
So 7 years, you know, regular full seasons of, you know, 4 episodes per arc. I mean, that's a lot of Tom Baker. And, you know.
Yeah, usually if people, I mean, Doctor Who has kind of gone mainstream the last 2 years or so. But before that, if you told people you were into Doctor Who, especially if they were of an older generation, they'd be like, oh, that guy on PBS with the scarf is usually what I would hear.
Yeah.
It's funny because for me, I had a weird proclivity for things of the British ilk anyway, because I'd seen like Fawlty Towers, you know, and Monty Python and Their Flying Circus and those episodes that you'd get on PBS and that kind of stuff. But I actually never ran across Doctor Who on PBS, and I don't know if it's just for whatever reason I never did, so I never caught on. And so actually for me last year, a friend of mine was like, okay, you need to watch Doctor Who. And I was like, okay, fine. You know, I knew about it because obviously, you know, being in the geek world, you hear about this Doctor Who thing. So I watched the first episode, and kind of like you there, Andy, I thought, ooh, Rose is, it's okay, you know, it's not great. But, you know, by the time I stuck with it, and by the time I got to the Doctor dances, I was totally hooked. I mean, you know, like, we stopped with the farting aliens, and we've gotten to this point where, like, this character just comes alive, and... I fell in love with it. And of course, then I heard that they were going to do the 50th anniversary and it was going to be in theaters. And I was like, well, I have to go to this. Well, I've got a lot of Doctor Who to watch. So in about a month and a half, watched all 7 seasons and got myself to the theater and was able to sit in a theater with a bunch of Doctor Who fans. And, you know, we filled up the entire theater. It was awesome. Who knew, you know, that were pun.
I heard that. Clap, clap, clap.
So it was just fantastic. And I've been back and I've watched some of the William Hartnell episodes, now, but I haven't gotten to go through too much there. The problem is I've found when you're trying to go back with the classic Doctor, you don't have as many episodes available on Netflix. So I think Hulu has more.
Netflix has done a better job of organizing them since Doctor Who became so popular in the U.S. But when I was first starting to watch the classic series, it was just before it hit, and they really made it tough. Like, I had to Google chronological order and, like, track down each individual episode. At least now they've put it all in one, you know, area, and they put it in order for you. But I was actually having to Wikipedia each Doctor and all of their episodes and then searching them and trying to find them so I could watch them in order. So they've actually done a better job. But yeah, I mean, they have a lot of missing stuff that's not available on Netflix, and they have the classic series has a lot of missing stuff that's just missing.
Yeah, so. Yeah, it is. Which is sad to know that there's an opportunity. There's episodes that we'll probably never see again because they just don't exist.
But then there was that really nice treasure that they found not too long ago an abandoned BBC station, and they offered it on iTunes, and I snapped that up, and I've been trying to get through some of it. Some of the restoration was actually really good, but I think for the most part, it's just being able to see brand new Doctor Who, even though it's Patrick Troughton's Doctor Who. It's never been offered before. in any form.
There's some Hartnell stuff that is just audio. They don't have the visuals for it, but you can, they'll put like a slideshow together of stills from the original episodes, and you can listen to the audio. So, I mean, they're it started to become like archaeology almost, like searching for lost Shakespearean plays and lost Hartnell episodes.
So what we really need is River to go find those missing episodes. And
they're probably in the vault somewhere.
And then
probably
look at
Torchwood.
Spoilers, exactly. Spoilers. It's so funny because going back and watching the first Doctor, it's super cheesy, obviously. The effects are terrible. But
I like the claymation TARDIS.
Yeah, but there's something about it that, I don't know. I can already see, what this show is. And I'm going back because I already have my roots now in the new series. But I can see this show clearly when I watch the old Doctor. And I would love, and I'm really excited to finally one day just go through and watch as many of them as I can to see all those old Doctors. Because, I know all these new Doctors, a lot of them pull a lot of what they do from, the old stuff. And it's so much fun when you can pull out and you'd be like, oh, that's that, and what they're doing. And so it's great. In fact, even in the newest episode with Capaldi, he pulls out jelly beans, which was fantastic.
Beans are babies.
He also references your episode, The Doctor Dances.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Are You My Mummy?
Yeah, it's just great. So, okay, so we kind of have an idea of how we got into the show, and now comes the part that is completely subjective, so we're not going to say that anybody should agree with us. It's just our personal things. So, Andy, going through, who's your favorite Doctor?
Oh, I'm a total unabashed Tennant fangirl.
Yay.
To be fair, I've seen at least a couple episodes of all of them, and I don't think there is one that is really bad. Some of the later classic series got to some terrible writing, which wasn't great for their characters, but I think all of the actors have been really good. But for whatever reason, the Tennant years have always really... That's when I got... A couple episodes into the second season, which was David Tennant's first year, is really when I got to the point where I was like, I must see every episode of this show forever and always. And that's really where my obsession was born. And he's just so pretty.
So. He really is. In fact, he's on that new show, Grace Point, which is just the redo of... Oh, gosh, hold on. I got to think of it. He's on that new show, Grace Point, which is the redo of Broadchurch, the British
series. Yeah, and Broadchurch was a really great show. So.
Yeah, exactly. Very dark and very different character for him. So, yeah, he has a lot of range, that's for sure.
Which is really important if you're going to play the Doctor, because the Doctor is so complex of a character.
Mm-hmm.
And Tennant he did a good job of keeping it fairly lighthearted, and then every once in a while he would really flip the switch and... be really brooding or sad or lonely or whatever he was trying to portray, and he's so pretty.
Hey, I'm not gonna lie, David Tennant is a good looking guy.
What's interesting to me is his face is really weird. If you like look at it in still photographs, he's got an odd looking face, but then he's got just charisma coming out of his ears, and when he's in movement and he's acting like the Doctor, he's just... he's still my favorite. He'll probably be my favorite forever. But I do really like all of the other Doctors, too. So,
what about you, Norm?
I think I'd have to answer that in two parts, because I do think that with the modern Doctor Who, there's a Doctor there that I love. And then the classic Doctor Who, there's a Doctor there that I love. And that's true, too. That would be Tom Baker. Because Tom Baker is, for me, he kind of like got the ball rolling. What I loved about Tom Baker is... Well, there's so many different things, but Tom Baker had this very cavalier yet serious quality about him. He could just look at something and just pay it no mind, or it would be just so whimsical to him. But then he would bring it back and just become so completely focused on something that no one cares about, and he kind of just loops that through the episode, the way that his personality works. He also was the doctor who had my favorite companion was Sarah Jane. You know, Sarah Jane, again, in the classic series, you know, Sarah Jane was always kind of like this great just companion full of questions and independence and this feistiness about her. You know, she kind of like tread forward where the doctor always sometimes was a little careful. She was a reporter, so she always wanted to get her story. So there was the classic doctor and companion, but here I have to agree. I think Tennant probably was closest to the mark of a doctor that would have beaten out Tom Baker in my overall list, because he had command of every single facet of his emotional range at any given time. So he could turn from that crazy what to a really dark what to a completely just clueless what, all in the same minute. And,
agreed.
You know, he bared his teeth, you know, when he was angry. No one says, "I'm so sorry," better than David Tennant. And
yeah, that is true.
You know, and then the one scene that is, it's still, to me, it's probably the most dramatic scene that I've seen in any of the Doctor's episodes, is when he had to say goodbye to Rose on the parallel Earth.
Mm. Beowulf Bay.
Spoilers for anyone who's listening to this. That scene alone just showed how much gravitas he had in his ability to make you as a character as a viewer focus on one singular moment. And that moment for me it's still one of the top three moments of Doctor Who of all time.
Yeah, I think that moment is so iconic because it's just pure emotion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's not a whole lot of plot distraction there. It really is a moment between two people that you've grown to care about and how they feel about each other, and just total heartbreaking, right in the feels moment. And it's nice when kind of the science fiction is important, but what's most important about any work of fiction is going to be your characters and the relationship to each other. And that was really beautifully done.
I agree.
Well, it was one of those things for me. I remember watching it and thinking to myself, who could surpass like Rose, you know, in my mind, you know, it just as a companion at that point. And then with Tennant as the doctor, like in that moment is all about just two people who really are the worst star-crossed lovers you've ever seen. You know, I mean, he's a 900-year-old alien and she's, you know, a 20-year-old shop girl from Earth, who's mortal. She's not, you know, gonna have a long life. So I mean, talk about Romeo and Juliet. It's such an awesome scene, and I'm with you guys. I completely love that. So it's funny because we're gonna have a Tennant love fest because he's my favorite too.
I don't think we're alone in that.
Yeah, and I don't think we are either. I know lots of I'm sure there's plenty of fans out there who may listen to this and they're going to scoff at us and be like, oh, then they could come on here and tell us exactly why we're wrong. But, you know, again, this is why I said this is completely subjective. This is, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, who you think your favorite doctor is. And so one of the things I have noticed before I get to why David's my favorite is that the more I see of Chris and I go back to watching Chris, the more I wish that Chris had stayed for another season.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah.
And the reason is because, you know, when they get to David Tennant's first episode, Christmas Invasion, that guy is barely in the episode. Really is. I mean, you just go back and watch it. He's really not in it that much. And yet the writing is just crackling at that point. I mean, they have found their groove. They know exactly what they're doing. And David just fills that role and fills the screen, you know. And it's sad to me because by the end of Chris Eccleston's run, they are just bang on with what they want to be doing in the show. They've really found their stride. They know what's going on. And so it saddens me that he left, because I think fans would have really fallen in love with him a lot more than they did if he had gotten a whole other season. And sometimes I feel like we kind of need a whole season to break it a doctor. I don't know. What do you guys, do you think, you guys think that too, maybe, or?
I agree. And I think the fact that the fans still connect with his doctor is a testament to how much he was able to do in that first season. And that first season is very up and down. I mean, they're still, they're rebooting a series that there's a lot of pressure. It's all, they still haven't, as you said, found their groove yet. And yet some of his moments, especially Dalek and Dalek, the rage that he shows and just the deep anger and gravitas. I mean, that guy could act. And there was a lot of layers, I think, that were that we would have loved to see from the Ninth Doctor. I would have loved to see another season of him exploring, because the way it is in the timeline, he has just gone through the most traumatic event in his, you know, at this point, 900-some years. And we're seeing the aftermath of his terrible decisions and all the guilt and everything. And I feel like it would have been amazing to see Christopher really, really delve into all of that. And it's sad that, you know, he didn't, apparently he didn't get along with the crew and the writers and the producers and stuff. And he didn't have a good experience shooting Doctor Who. And that's, it's too bad because he was great. And I think the fans like really connected to his version of the Doctor.
When I think of what he could have done then too in the 50th anniversary, you know, if he had wanted to come back, it would have been him instead of the War Doctor. And just how amazing that would have been to see him and Tennant and Smith all together. And he would have had a ton to do in that episode, and I think would have pulled it off brilliantly. And it was sad to me that he did have such a bad experience and didn't want to go back, that he let that go. I think he may regret that later on in life, not going back, but who knows. But it was sad to me that what could have been in the 50th anniversary. Now, on a whole, that's probably one of my favorite episodes ever, because it was brilliant and they pulled it off beautifully. Just a fantastic episode, but it could have been something completely different if you had had all three of those doctors and in one episode.
But we did get Tom Baker at the end.
Yes,
that is true. And that was wonderful.
When I heard his voice, it's unmistakable that it's Tom Baker.
Yeah, and it is. It hasn't changed much, really.
and when I saw him, what I loved about that scene was that A, you know, it brings back a very popular doctor, and B, some of the design work was also very reminiscent of his original TARDIS from, you know, the mid to late 1970s, the white disc type of motif that was very much like the inside of, you know, well, his and Davison's TARDIS. So there was some nice kind of detail that harkened back, and it allowed to bridge the gap between what was and what is. And I thought that they were really smart doing that to please some of the some wee older fans. So.
Well, they did a really good job of setting the tone of the 50th anniversary through design aspects, through just word choices. They did a really good job of incorporating it in a organic way, because nobody needs to get hit over the head that, oh, it's the 50th anniversary, let's discuss all of the... They just, you know, slid them in. So if you were a fan of the classic series, you got it. If you weren't a fan, it didn't detract from your enjoyment. So I think they did a lovely job of balancing it.
I think there's a lot that, in the end, obviously there was an article that was great. I think it was on IO9 about what Star Trek can learn from Doctor Who in its 50th anniversary. And I think there's a lot that Star Trek could learn of what to do, and hopefully they'll do some of it, especially with something as special as, you know, the 50th anniversary for Doctor Who fans, I think, was just kind of universally loved and pulled off so beautifully. And they were doing such a great job of you know, marketing what was coming. They were giving us some great stuff, merchandising, just everything was working together to create an amazing experience for fans of this show, especially, as you were saying, any people who had stayed with the show for so long. You know, they were being rewarded with little things that, you know, unless you had, you wouldn't get, you know. And I think that that speaks to how highly that the runners of the show now just kind of feel about the show and realize the gravitas and the gravity of the situation that they were in to make sure that they take care of the fans who have been there for the longest time, as well as trying to win out new fans. And I think they're doing a good job on both ends, especially with the 50th.
Have either of you seen the BBC special, The Adventure in Space and Time?
Yeah, that was fantastic.
This one was kind of like a historical take on how Doctor Who came to be with the first ever female producer for the BBC, Verity Lambert. And how she fought really hard to bring this vision to life, and how they gave her absolutely zero support in terms of production budget, and kind of except for one producer, except for her boss, who kind of like let her swing for the fences. But for the listeners out there, if you want to learn a little bit more about the history of Doctor Who and how it had some growing pains, and how literally one woman was able to change the face of science fiction, do yourself a favor and watch that, because the amount of just sheer willpower that she had to exert on getting this project through was just, it's mind blowing. And we all have to thank her for it, because, you know, without
her, sounds awesome. I'll have to check that out.
It's really fantastic.
Oh, you do. I think in fact you can even get a copy of it on some of the 50th anniversary DVDs or Blu-rays that some of them I think have come with that as a part of it. And they, on iTunes, they also had a package where you got like the Doctor Who 50th anniversary, and it had all these specials with it, and one of them was Adventures in Space and Time. So, oh my gosh, it's completely worth it. It's well produced, and the actors they have playing the parts are fantastic. In fact, one of the actress who plays Verity was actually on an episode of Doctor Who from the 7th season, so that's really cool. And it, just a random tidbit too, one of my favorite Star Trek authors, Una McCormick, named her daughter Verity as well, which I thought was really cool, because she's a huge Doctor Who fan. So, I never finally got to who my favorite Doctor is and why. And people are just waiting for bated breath right now, probably. My favorite Doctor is David. I love David Tennant, and I think, like Andy, what you said, the reason that I love him is because of the joy, like the ultimate joy he has in playing the Doctor. Like he doesn't have that like boyishness that Smith has. He just, his face, it just lights up when he's excited, you know? And you can tell that there's nothing that David Tennant wants to be doing more than being the Doctor. And to me, that just kind of imbibed the spirit of, you know, who this character is. Like, at the core, as sad as he was about what he had done and everything else, there's still a joy in him that loves what he does of traveling the galaxy. And so for me, he just won me over, and I love that. That's not to take, again, there's some great moments with Smith too, that I just love. I like all three of the new doctors, and I'm learning to really love Capaldi as well for what he's bringing to it. And I think that's the thing about that I really love about Doctor Who, and I think it's probably one of the reasons why it lasts for so long, is because in some ways it reinvents itself every time and yet stays the same. And it gives you a lot to be able to explore then over and over and over again, and just, you know, great variations on a theme. So it's the same character, but, you know, different things are pointed out each time. And I think that's just one of the things I really love about it. So,
well, I mean, Doctor Who's concepts can last forever. I mean, the very basic concept of they can go anywhere in time and space and have any adventure. I mean, the writing possibilities for that are endless. You're never going to run out of stories to tell. And then adding the regeneration aspect, where each doctor highlights a different characteristic of the doctor and new ways to unpack his character and kind of explore who this being is over all of the years. I mean... You can't get much better as a concept for a TV show.
Well, I think the neat thing about Doctor Who is, and it's the roulette wheel, really. It's kind of, you know, you roll the dice and you take your chances and see if this particular doctor, his personality, the personality of the companion that he's either going to inherit or find or discover somebody new, is that going to resonate, you know, with a certain crowd? Because I think that any given point in time, a Doctor Who fan can kind of like step out for a moment, miss a season or two, come back, and still understand that this is still the Doctor. The trappings are still there. The TARDIS is still there. You know, the whole point of his being is to roam the cosmos and figure out, you know, what's interesting or what's new or what needs to be fixed, or does he have the right to fix it? Does he have the right to interfere? What does his companion have to say about that? What has his companion done that he needs to repair? You know, with all of, you know, the years and, you know, the decades that have come before this current incarnation of the series, I haven't really seen a lot of repetition there, because the variety and the variation and all the different angles that you can get with Doctor Companion relationships and Doctor Ally relationships. I mean, Jack Harkness threw a huge monkey wrench in the,
yes,
you know, in all of the relationship between the Doctor and the Companion, because he wasn't technically the traveling companion. He had his own mission, you know, having Mickey and having Rose's mom all in there. They're just, the variety is always fresh. And every time you introduce new companions, you bring along their, you know, for lack of a better word, their baggage. You know, Donna had her own issues. Wilfred, God, I can't even speak enough good
Wilfred.
Words. You know, I mean, good Lord, the end of Tennant and Wilfred was just heartbreaking.
It had,
you know,
to be you.
Right.
You had to go in there.
Right? You know, and it's not fair. I mean, it's hard for me to watch it and still not just break out emotionally.
Dude, stop. You're going to make me tear up right here. God, Norm.
Great scene.
Jeez.
Great scene.
And, so good.
You know,
so good.
And then, you know, you come in with, you know, Rory and Amy, you know, and they have their
Rory
fantastic relationship and how River fits into all that, without spoiling too much for those who haven't seen their
You can spoil it. If you haven't watched Doctor Who, folks, I mean, I'm sorry, but we're going to spoil things rotten. So this is your warning, your final warning, your only warning. Go, Norm.
But then you have the blue box, you have the madman, you have the companion, and then you have this blank canvas almost every single time a regeneration happens, because I think that they're, you know, I think Moffat was smart enough, and Russell T. Davies before that, they were smart enough to know that the audience is so vast and has such a great appetite for all the different directions, they'll find something that they really want to watch if they want to watch it and stick with it. You know, some will hit more than others, but, you know, by and large, you know, Doctor Who still has its quote-unquote tenets that people like to follow.
Well, and I mean, you were saying that you can check out of a season and come back. Honestly, I think even now, when we're more into the modern kind of series serial aspect of TV, whereas it used to be that Doctor Who was like different parts of a single story, you can take Doctor Who episode by episode. I mean, you can watch 6 episodes of the new series and totally get a sense of Doctor Who, you know, and basically every time I sit down to watch an episode, I am going to take it on its own terms, because they are usually such contained stories. I mean, you occasionally have the arcs, you know, season finale or, you know, stuff like that, kind of a series long arc that's wrapped up. But for the most part, each adventure is contained. So you can watch, you know, one episode, skip a couple episodes and get to the next one and not really lose much, because at the end of the day, it's still going to be the TARDIS opens, the Doctor and the Companion walk out, and they save the day somehow. And it could get tired, but it does not. So I really think that that's a strength of the show, because you can hate an episode and then love an episode. And, you know, goodness knows Doctor Who fans like to discuss everything good and everything bad and who works and who doesn't for them and disagree on every single episode. So it's kind of cool that you can take each story on its own merits.
And I think that's a great segue into asking then, who is your favorite companion and or companions?
For me, actually, Norm was saying that he has the classic Doctor and the the new Doctor. My favorite classic Doctor is actually William Hartnell, the first Doctor, because I just think it's hilarious how much of a jerk he is.
Yeah.
and it really makes me laugh. I have the same for classic companion and updated companion. My favorite classic companion is actually Ian Chesterton. Who is actually like the first companion, but he was just such a great guy, and he is really, you can see him making an impact on the Doctor and helping him find his humanity, and then just brave and funny and sweet and everything that you want from a companion. And then for the new companion, I got to stick with Rose. She's my gal. I just really think that she has a lot of heart, and she really embodies what the companion is supposed to be. As much as I enjoy kind of the romantic relationship her and Ten had, it's not even really the romance that I like so much about her. It's that she's a truth teller. She's going to tell him what he needs to hear, and also just pure loyalty. You know, she's always going to be right there backing him up, and they just had an amazing chemistry. So Rose is my favorite, closely followed by Donna.
Oh, I loved amazing. Donna. Oh, Donna.
It took me a long time to like Donna. She grated on me for so long, and then now that I watch her again, it's completely different. But I remember the shock of, you know, no Rose, and now we've got Donna, and it was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, that first Christmas special, those first 10 minutes, I was
horrible.
Like, what is happening to me right now?
She's horrible.
Was that the Runaway Bride?
She's so the opposite of Rose, and she's very obnoxious. But then you realize that underneath all that is just this brave, witty woman. And I really enjoyed her very platonic relationship with the Doctor, mm-hmm. which was much needed mm-hmm. after the romantic shenanigans. And talk about a truth teller. I mean, no one was more blunt than Donna. and then, of course, Catherine Tate, just being the extraordinary comedian that she is, really brought a lot of laughs and a lot of heart to a role, but then also, again, managed to flip it. I think what happens to Donna is possibly the most heartbreaking thing to happen to a companion on New Who. It's just, she grew so much, and then they took it all away from her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those two, her and Wilfred, her grandfather, that is a great companionship for the Doctor, and one of the most challenging for him, I think, because they really, you know, push him to grow. So yeah, definitely, that whole arc with them, now I watch it again, and it's just fantastic.
Well, I mean, I already mentioned Sarah Jane before, but what I love about Sarah Jane is that she was able to bridge two of my favorite doctors with John Pertwee and Tom Baker. But she was always so plucky. I think that's the right word for her, because she kind of always forged on ahead, again, with her background as being a reporter. And, when I started watching Doctor Who, those were in kind of like my formative years as like a, you know, adolescent teenager, and she was just, oh my God, I just fell head over heels for her, because she was gorgeous.
Beautiful.
And she had the British accent, and she was very elegant. And I don't know, it's just one of the, I always thought that she played off her doctors really well, because it's not that she wouldn't listen to them, it's that they had to give her a really good reason why. And for, you know, young adults or young viewers, I mean, that's kind of like the, why would you tell me to do that? Why do I have to stay in the TARDIS? Why can't I go after that giant mummy, you know, referencing the pyramids of Mars, or, you know, just stuff like that. So she would try and find, she was a sleuth, and she liked, you know, sleuthing around. And yes, obviously that got her into trouble sometimes, but, you know, it also gave the Doctor a chance to, show off and, you know, prove his wits and his reasoning. And Tom Baker was always just exasperated with her. And it was just so they had such a hot and cold relationship. You know, there's not really a lot of romance there. And then when she came back, or flashing forward, you know, so many decades, when she came back in the episode with Tennant.
Oh, fantastic.
When she saw him and realized who he was, it compressed all of those decades of time to where you, as a viewer who have been fans of both both incarnations of the series, you're like, wow, that just made my heart stop for a second, because I remember when he left her and she was so angry, but at the same time so back in love with seeing him again, as we all were. So yeah, Sarah Jane for the past and for the future. I loved Donna. I mean, I loved where Rose was with the Doctor, but Donna was Rose without the romance for me. She was just, yes, she was a truth teller, and she was blunt as the biggest hammer you can find sometimes, you know, and she had, I thought it was refreshing for her to be that way, because you had Rose, which is a very serious romantic issue between her and the Doctor. Then you had Martha, who I thought was actually a good companion, but she couldn't recapture that kind of romance. I mean, it was already done. And again, the whole ending with Tennant and Billy Piper was just solid. It was done. It was packaged perfectly. It was put that on the shelf and just let that thing be. Martha couldn't get that back. So Donna was just able to take it in a completely fresh direction and just be this brash, loud, inquisitive, feisty person that had Wilfred to temper her, or had Wilfred to be that kind of other voice of reason that she didn't have with the Doctor. So that dynamic was really good, because it wasn't just about her. It was about who she brought with her. And I thought that Wilfred, by and large, was the second of that companion relationship. I mean, he was, really was her heart, in a way.
Going back to Sarah Jane, she's... I got to put in some words for Sarah Jane, because she's awesome. She's by and large, whenever they have polls, always hits the top for favorite companion. And that's really because she's a very classic companion. I mean, not only does she have the longest run of all of the Doctors, I mean, she has four Doctors. That's amazing. But she was also the first female companion that they wrote to do anything other than be rescued. I mean, we were talking earlier about the female producer that had issues. Well, when they first brought Sarah Jane on, the producers at the time were reluctant to have anything but a damsel in that role. I mean, basically the role of the companion was to scream a lot and get rescued. And Sarah Jane was the first female companion that really held her own against the Doctor and did it so beautifully, and just... a really wonderful companion. So I just gotta say that I love Sarah Jane too.
High five.
What I like about this one too is that we are definitely not all the same. And for me, my favorite companion and companions are Rory and Amy. I remember, you know, watching through the series, and I'm thinking, okay, who can ever take the place of Rose? And it wasn't going to be Martha, and it wasn't going to be Donna, and it wasn't going to be any of those people for me. And then, you know, we get to season 5 and it opens, and it is just big and loud and bombastic. And you can tell they're spending more money on everything. The 11th Hour is just a great episode. And Matt Smith and Karen Gillan immediately have that, like, you know, witty banter back and forth, and the chemistry for it to work. And when you added Rory in there with him, it was just amazing. And so for me, those were the companions that I completely fell head over heels for. And obviously Karen Gillan, she's Scottish and she has red hair.
Check.
So yeah, so I was completely a goner. And it, yeah, I really was. I was, there was no other companion that was going to compare at that point. And what I loved too is just the way that they were the companions too who really got to the Doctor, which I thought was interesting. Like, they're the only ones who made him almost want to live a normal life. He knew that they couldn't do it forever, you know, and he wanted to, like, it's, he's trying to push them away, you know, and make them live their own normal life. He almost wants to be able to do it with them. And I just thought that that was some great growth. And to me, that, oh God, there's no more heartbreaking scene. And I can even be listening to the music and it gets me. in the feels, but when they leave in Angels Take Manhattan, it is just, to me, it's heartbreaking. Especially after Rory's gone, and you know, Matt Smith is just pleading with her. He's like, you know, Amy, come back to the TARDIS. Just come back to the TARDIS with me right now. You know, it's oh man, it's heartbreaking. So to me, that scene is like, I don't love season seven. Season seven has a lot of problems for me, but that just, it broke my heart when they left. That's one of the best acted scenes I'd seen in Doctor Who too. Just him and her in that scene was fantastic. And then of course Rivers on the other side telling her, yes, you can go, you know. Ugh, goodness. Anyway, I love them as companions. It was really cool too, because it's the only time you had a married couple as companions as well.
It's a different vibe, that's really welcome at that point, because at that point you only had, you know, pretty women, you know, and even with Donna, who was very platonic, but then you had Martha and Rose being kind of pseudo love interests, and then you go with Amy and Rory, and there's a little bit of tension with Amy at the beginning, but then it settles into this married couple on an adventure with the Doctor as like extended honeymoon or something, and it was a very different vibe that was very cool.
What I loved about when you introduce more than one companion, you bring into the writing and the situation what I like to call the Star Trek effect, where you have the triumvirate kind of personalities. You know, you have Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, you know, or in this case, what I thought was really successful about Matt Smith with Amy and Rory is that you had Amy was one way, Rory was a very other way, and then they both kind of affected Matt Smith in one way or the other, either by you know, directly, like when Rory punches the Doctor, you know, when he was,
oh, that's awesome,
you know, because he was, you know, are you human? You know, it's like, yes, I am. Bam, you know, she's important to me. Bam, you know.
yeah.
And so you as a viewer can latch on to that emotion. You know, however, you know, Amy, you know, goes about her relationship with the Doctor or her Doctor's relationship with Amy, I think there's more chemistry involved when you have, you know, a multiple character experience as opposed to a singular, well, not singular, but a dual character experience. Like, I always loved it when they peppered in Jack, because Jack was just, he was spice. That's, I mean,
stop,
he was,
it.
You know,
I just said hello.
Mm-hmm. You know,
it's a wild card.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, he always brought in something rogue and radical, and you never knew where you were going to end up with him storytelling wise. And it was just, you know, John Barrowman was just an amazing, amazing character to watch. And I hold River Song in the same regard. Alex Kingston, because, you know, they're not really a companion quote unquote per se, but when they come in at companion strength, and they really add a lot to the flavor and changing the chemistry of the entire situation. So, as much as I like having like a single companion, you know, you got to have that like third kind of like variable in sometimes, just to, you know, give Kirk his Spock or McCoy situation where, do I listen to him? Do I listen to him? Do I listen to myself? What's the feel with Rory? I actually liked Rory a lot, just because he always felt like he was making the sense out of everything. Why are we doing this?
He grounded them. He grounded both of them.
You know, you know, Amy was really excited all the time about doing this. It was something that was just, you know, she wanted to fly to the, you know, so the fly to the seat of her pants. You know, she's been waiting for the Doctor to come back all these years. And then all of a sudden, Rory's like, well, what happens to me? Who am I? You know, it's like your dream Doctor has finally come back, like you've been saying all this time. And now, where's my place? My place is, I'm the man who fell in love with you. I'm the man who's going to marry you. I'm the man who's going to take care of you as the boy who waited.
Quick question before we move on, because we could spend an entire episode on this. What did your thought on just whether you liked or didn't like River Andy?
I liked her less as her story unraveled. I thought she worked really well as a mystery, and then when we learned more and more and more about her, it worked less for me. As a character, I like her. I like the idea of her. I just don't think she was very well served by the story or by the writing as much as I would have liked to see. I mean, having it all come down to she becomes the doctor's wife was just a little bit of a letdown for me.
What about you, Norm?
Yeah, I have to agree. I think when we first saw her in, was it Silence of the Library?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that what happened to her there and the intrigue involved with her character bringing in the diary, the, well, because it's a prop, the modified version of Ten's sonic screwdriver from the future, that was all very interesting. But, and I may be on a very small island when it comes to this opinion, but for me, the more that Moffat got involved as showrunner, the less I felt the quality of his storytelling came through.
Yes.
When he was doing shows like Silence of the Library or, for me, the in this all of this new Doctor Who, Blink, I think is probably the best episode of this entire series so far. When he was focused as just a writer, I think that he was able to bring out the best of everything that is the Doctor. The characters, the supporting characters, just the overall feel and kind of like this strange tilt in the universe where you're not really, it's not really formulaic anymore. But as he became showrunner from five on in, I felt that he was focusing more on these giant, colossally complicated, complex arcs. And I think that River Song's character lost a little in translation there. I think Alex was a brilliant, I mean, she's brilliant.
Yeah,
she's fantastic in the show. I mean, anytime she's on, she's just, you know, lighting it up for sure. So, but I know on a whole, a lot of people just have problems with her character. And for one, I like her. And, you know, I can definitely acknowledge the issues. You know, for me, season five is in a fantastic season. I think on a whole, it works together so well. Moffat had a lot of time to craft that season and really put that together. He had a very long time to do that, and I think it shows because that season, even as you just kind of, if you watch it again, there's everything works together really well. Season six, they're telling an even bigger story, one that's even more convoluted, and it just doesn't work as well. And so I agree with you guys. Her character just kind of doesn't get served as much as it could have. I didn't have any problem with her being the doctor's wife. I thought it was fantastic that, you know, you kind of knew from the beginning that the only reason she knew this special thing she could tell Ten, you know, that there was this relationship. I thought it was great. How it was all going to come down was fantastic. It just wasn't as exciting as it could have been, I think, to me, in the revelation of how it happens.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've both nailed what is problematic with Moffat as a writer. I mean, he just keeps trying to top himself, and the way that he feels like he needs to top himself is writing these plots that are doing all of these fantastical things that don't actually hold up when you start to think about them. And it's like he thinks that the more sci-fi plot that he throws at us, the less that we need to know how it works. It's like a big magic trick, but it doesn't quite work. And I think that he's really lost his way when it comes to his characters, and making sure that the relationships and the characters hold true. And I just don't think that they're as well served as they could be because he's too busy trying to put as many things into the episode as humanly possible, and he doesn't let it breathe. He doesn't let his characters breathe. There's very few little character moments that could really help. Yeah, it's sad to me because I agree that when he was doing one-off episodes, he was amazing, and there's no doubt that he's a talented guy and a talented writer, and he comes up with cool ideas and cool characters. It's just, it feels like he's trying to do too much, and it just becomes overwhelming.
And I think that leads us straight into, and then we want to get into now is, and the last things that we'll talk about is Capaldi in season eight. And so for you guys, just kind of overview, what do you think about season eight so far, what you've seen?
I've seen it all up until The Mummy on the Orient Express, And I have to say that there hasn't been an episode that's really stood out to me in terms of, like, the episode, you know? I mean, if we're talking The Doctor's Wife or Blink or Midnight, you know, those episodes that really stand out, I don't think that season 8 has had a standout episode yet. None of them are particularly bad, but none of them are particularly great either. It's just very in the middle. And then whatever the mystery is that he is leading towards, I'm not all that interested in it, which is not a good sign.
Well, what do you think, Norm?
One of the things that I think that there are a couple people that I know that I talk about Doctor Who with pretty regularly, and we all feel that we are suffering a little bit from overexposure. Even at best, Star Trek only ran, Star Trek The Next Generation ran for 7 seasons, DS9 7 seasons, Voyager 7 seasons. This is the 8th season of Doctor Who. And what I think that people are starting to probably suffer from a little bit is a little bit of overexposure, a little bit of, okay, so what makes this special? If you're not coming out with a bang or a villain that you can latch your teeth onto or something that allows a new and general public to come into a show and say, I've heard of this, but what is the hook about it? I really don't get it. I really wish that it would probably, like, they would, like, just drop hints on bringing back the Master, because that's always been a classic. I mean, it's like the classic Doctor Who villain that you don't really get to see a lot of. You see the Daleks all the time. You see the Cybermen in One Final all the time. You even seen the Silurians, you know, recently. But, you know, the last time we saw the Master was, what was it, at the end of season 3 with John Sim, and that was it. It just went whoosh. And he's such a huge force. I wish that Moffat has the ability and the skill and the writing knowledge and lore to be able to bring back them, even though that we believe that we lost in his last generation, he could bring him back. We saw him again at the end of Tennant's run with the return of Rassilon. But there is a way, and it would be neat to see this superpowered villain like the Master come back and challenge Capaldi, because I think Capaldi is a great actor. I just don't think he's been given great material yet. And sadly enough, the only episode of Clara that I've liked so far was her introductory episode in season 7 when she was trapped in, you know, when the reveal of the Dalek was, you know, kind of like just dropped on your head. And you're like, wow, that was just, I haven't seen Moffat writing like that in a long time.
He's just been writing her very generically.
Right. And I haven't really cared for her since, which is too bad because I think that she's a fantastic actress. She's pretty, she's plucky, she has a lot of great attributes for what I get is a standard companion. And maybe that's also the thing, you know, we're running into kind of like the standard companion formula. I mean, why not have a male companion for a while? If written right, it can be just as effective as a female companion. So I don't know. I guess it's kind of half-baked right now a little bit. And we don't know what the future is going to, you know, bring for the wrapping up of this season, but I just don't think Capaldi's been given enough material to really show off what doctor he is. You know, where does his flavor go?
Yeah, I think this is one of those seasons. It almost seems like a season 9 or a season with 9 with Eccleston, and they were really reintroducing the Doctor in a lot of ways, because Capaldi's Doctor is so very different from what we've seen in the last, you know, few Doctors. And so far I've liked Capaldi a lot. I think he's bringing a lot to the role. I think it's making it interesting for me because I don't know this Doctor. Like, I don't know what he's going to do. I have no idea what his, like, his reactions are going to be for things, which I'm finding really interesting. I almost feel like, too, that he's, to me, I think that this is the most interesting I've seen Clara, because they're actually making her a person instead of the impossible girl, which was annoying to me because she wasn't a character. She was just a prop at that point for the show. And now, watching her, she is more fully rounded, like, They're diving into her. We know whether I care about Danny Pink or not, it's a totally different story, but the fact that they're just making her a more rounded character and she's having to kind of figure things out with this new doctor, I'm enjoying that part. I didn't really like Clara before, but I do like her now. Is she going to be one of my favorite companions? I don't think so. But I'm finding her much more interesting, and I'm interested as she's kind of like having to take this doctor. And whereas the other doctor, you know, with Smith, she was, you know, he's this boy man she's having to take care of, you know, this doctor with Capaldi, he's alien, and she's almost, I feel like, kind of having to teach him a little bit what it means to be more human, which I think is kind of interesting as well. For me, the standout episodes, I don't know about you guys, but I really liked the Robot of Sherwood. As dumb as the episode was, I just thought it was kind of fun.
The moment where he's spoon fighting stands out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Spoon fighting, or, you know, I enjoy those kind of episodes. I think they're, when they're okay with just being goofy and doing goofy things, it works with Doctor Who because that's part of the show, and I liked that they were okay with that. Because I kind of cringed when I first heard about the episode, and then I turned out really liking it. And then to me, I also really enjoyed Listen for the season. I think that to me was the standout because the connection with the 50th anniversary, and that we actually meet the Doctor as a child. And, you know, we're actually in the barn before it's a wasteland. You know, the doctor's asleep up there. And the interesting thing of Clara having the role in his life, I just thought that was a really neat thing. And instead of her being the impossible girl where she has this very vague thing where she saves the doctor all the time, this was so concrete, you know, that she's met him before at the very beginning, before he's even a Time Lord, before he's looked into the vortex. I thought that was just hands down kind of amazing. And that was one of those things where I was like, okay, I can see where, you know, Moffat has this thing where he really likes to explore the idea of the doctor, and who the doctor is as a character, instead of just kind of having him be a prop for things happening. So I've enjoyed the series on a whole. I'd say it's much better for me than season 7 was. And mainly because I feel like it's more cohesive. Like, even though the episodes have been kind of standalone and there's been kind of just this kind of thread going through them, they've had a good story, I thought, with the Doctor. I've enjoyed the storyline with Clara more. It's, you know, for me, the low point of the new Doctor Who, on a whole, is season 7. The 50th anniversary is its own thing for me. So I don't know. I still don't know what to think about it completely, because it's not done yet. And so I don't, for me, you know, too, I realize with Doctor Who, a lot of times, especially with the new Doctor Who, you kind of end up having to judge things by a whole season.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like I still need to see the end of this season to completely be able to judge how good or bad it is. And so we'll see. I don't know. But personally, Capaldi to me is making the character worth going back and trying to figure out what he's going to do. Especially for me, Andy, I know you just watched Mummy on the Orient Express. The whole back and forth with him there with Clara, I thought was really cool, because, you know, she thinks he's one way, and when they talk, it turns out that he's different than she thought.
I do think that Capaldi is really letting us explore, like, the alien side of the Doctor more. I mean, we went through both Tennant and Smith had a kind of silly, goofy, I don't know if that's the right word, but kind of lighthearted take, and then they would go darker if the, you know, the writing demanded it or whatever, but their overall personalities were pretty lighthearted, whereas Capaldi is, I don't think you could call him a lighthearted doctor. For one thing, he is a bit meaner. We've seen...
It's the eyebrows!
Yeah, and I mean, bless him, Peter Capaldi does mean very, very entertainingly. I mean, that's kind of his calling card as an actor.
But he does it in a very Gandalf kind of way. You know, it's like everything just seems a slightly more, he's just slightly more irritable than everybody else, you know?
Yeah, just absolutely. Just too smart for everybody, and everybody annoys him kind of thing. And personally, I don't think that that's a bad thing. I think it's a nice change of pace. And it certainly brings out different aspects of his character than we've been exploring, at least recently. So I've been enjoying Capaldi. Clara, I've always thought, has kind of been a blank canvas. I feel like she becomes what she's needed to be for the episode. I think you describing her as like a plot device rather than a character is pretty apt. I mean, she seems to just be there to be by his side and make, you know, quips when is necessary, and which is really not fair to the actress, because she's great. And when they give her more interesting things to do, she clearly can handle it. I don't know. I think that they could do better for her. It is nice to see her have relationships outside of the doctor, because it does give her character a little more to work with, and she definitely is improving, and I think she has a cool vibe with Capaldi, so I'm interested to see how it works out.
Especially with the newer Doctor Who series, you have to kind of just, you know, take the whole thing as like one giant story, you know, because like before in the classic ones, it was always kind of like Monster of the Week, a lot of kind of, you know, that kind of fun, but the way that Moffat writes, it's one giant chapter, you know, broken up in all these little different pauses, and I haven't caught up as far as by this podcast as far as you guys are in the series. So, you know, I love Capaldi. I love him on Three Musketeers. I think he's amazing on Three Musketeers. The Musketeers. And I was really looking forward to seeing more of what he can do as the Doctor.
So final thoughts from you guys just on Doctor Who, and especially maybe if somebody hasn't checked it out, or if they got stuck on Rose, you know, Give people the reasons you think why you should watch Doctor Who.
For me, I think Doctor Who is almost genreless. It's like, is it science fiction? It even has some fairy tale elements. It's silly. It's dark. It's funny. It's serious. It's dramatic. It's basically every kind of emotion you can have while watching a TV show, you will get from Doctor Who. That's really the highlight of the series for me, is depending on which episode you're watching and depending on what moment you're watching from the episode, it really takes you on a roller coaster of the human experience, really. It's just, I mean, it's romantic and interesting and strange. All things can be encompassed in Doctor Who, and I think that's really unique, especially these days on television, to have a show that really hits all of the emotions and all of the buttons.
The one thing that I want to advise a lot of newer comers to Doctor Who, or if you want to try out Doctor Who, is that don't take a look at the entirety of Doctor Who as a whole and say, I have to watch it all, because that's not what it's about. It's about what's your flavor? Like, do you like 1970s science fiction or 1960s science fiction? Do you like the actors? Do you like what you've heard? Do you like what you've seen on social media? I mean, David Tennant has had a great long run. Do you like great effects? Does that drive you? I mean, it's really hard to pigeonhole what about Doctor Who someone should latch onto, because it's, I don't want to use it as a pun, but it is kind of timeless. I mean, it's, you know, it's 50 years of TV continuously, you know, that's a lot of TV to try and digest or try and wrap your arms around as a fan. So for me, when I started watching, I liked it because it was one of the channels that I got on TV that was science fiction. Same thing with classic Star Trek. And as I grew with it, my tastes grew, and I kind of left it for a while. I came back and it was still the same. You know, the Doctor was in his blue box, had a companion, wanted to travel the galaxy and see what kind of stories that they could become a part of or create. And I think that's a great thing about science fiction writing, is that it it can appeal to everybody as long as you keep your mind open enough for it to affect. You know, because not everything is going to be blank, and not everything is going to... I'm not going to say the worst episode of Doctor Who because I don't think there is one, but not everything is going to be top, not everything is going to be bottom, but things are going to strike your fancy that you're like, you know what? I'd like to explore more of Tom Baker or Peter Davison or Sylvester McCoy or Christopher Eccleston or David Tennant. There's so much. So if you want to get into Doctor Who, talk to a friend who's a fan, ask for them to lend you their DVDs or to borrow their computer or watch it on Netflix or however you want to get it, because it's all good. You know, it just really depends on what depth of the pool you want to dive into first.
Yeah, I'm with you both. I think that this show, you know, having just got into it a year ago now, and at this point a year ago, I was really diving in and trying to get through all the seasons so I could get to that 50th anniversary and see it in the theaters. It's a fantastic show. You know, Star Trek says that it's about exploring the human experience. And I think that Doctor Who is very much like that as well. It gives you the opportunity to just think about and explore the galaxy and ideas and religion and science and all of these kind of things in all these different ways. And it's a show that, as silly as it is, it'll make you think. And I think that that's priceless on television. And so I definitely encourage you, if you haven't seen Doctor Who before, if you tried it before, go back and try it again. You know, I've talked to a lot of people. Some people will start with Smith and go from there and then go backwards. Or, you know, there's a lot of different starting places with Doctor Who. For me, the best way was to start with Rose, and I just kept going forward. By midway through that first season there with Eccleston, he just hooked me. It just hooked me, and I couldn't stop at that point. So I think that it is just one of the most fun things that you can end up watching. And I truly do enjoy it, and I'm so thankful that a friend of mine just made me sit down and watch it and then made me keep going. And so I'm very excited that... we got a chance to talk about this on the 602 Club. Well, it's been fun talking about Doctor Who today, but that's not the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Because we're basically pitching a story arc.
Right.
Like we're Babylon 5, and we've got this five-year arc.
Yeah.
But we're going to have a 3-year plus maybe the cartoons plus the movies arc.
Earl Grey.
Billy has 25 self-stealing symbols that he needs to trade with a non-Federation species using a different currency. What does Billy do?
The Orb.
They've already been kind of to that next step. I mean, he massages her all the time and helps her out of the tub again.
He knows that she has rashes on her thighs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so...
To the journey! You know, talk about a heavy-handed message.
Literally, on your back!
Literally, on your back. Like, I want you to feel the weight. You know, this is the kind of non-subtlety that makes it fun. Warp 5.
The fact of the matter is, Bakula is playing this character just as he should. It's true that Archer seems a bit uneasy, lacking in confidence. But he's the first human captain to see these strange new worlds.
The Ready Room.
I haven't gotten to the point in my research where I'm that caught up. I mean, I'm very much stuck right in season one of Next Gen and kind of have
That's
blinders
kind of
on everything else right now. Yeah, boy, tell me about it.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
And we have kind of reached a milestone here, a little earlier than you might think we would have reached that milestone. This is the final episode of Star Trek for which we have a writing credit given to Gene Roddenberry.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
And he wanted the first part to be called Becoming Houdini, and the second part to be called Being Houdini.
Should have been called Houdini Begins.
Yes.
And Houdini Rises.
Yes.
Melodic Treks.
At only 22 years of age, he conducted the Munich Symphony Orchestra using 110 pieces a 60-piece choir, and a 30-piece children's choir. Sometimes you need the children to get them high notes.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That really helps us out greatly and makes it easier for the other listeners to find the show as they search in iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. And you can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and the different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support that you can give to us, and we hope that you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And please leave a review in iTunes. Reviews help people find us in the iTunes store when they search for our podcasts. And when you leave a review, we'll give you a shout-out on the show. Of course, you can contact us at trek.fm/contact. If you'd like to leave a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. You can go to Twitter at trekfm. And then, of course, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. You can also join us in our listeners-only club. That's at the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference in the search field on Facebook or go to the website at trekfm and click the discussion on the menu bar. And before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps bring the 602 Club and all of our shows to you each week. Our sponsor for this show, of course, is Audible.com. Audible is a great way to read all of those books that you've always wanted to and never had time for. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with that 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm to sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for their support of the 602 Club and the network. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can make that happen. Just visit enterprise.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. Now, guys, where can we find you online, Andy?
The easiest place to find me is on Twitter, at First Time Trek, where I'm live tweeting my first watch of Star Trek.
Awesome. That's great. Where are you right now, by the way?
I am about midway through the second season of the original series.
Awesome. Awesome. How are you liking the second season?
It's very up or down for me. I just watched the episode where they go to the gangster planet, and that was super fun. So
piece of the action.
You learned about Fizbin.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's actually my favorite episode of the original series.
It was just delightful. We were talking about how Doctor Who is silly. Good science fiction can be silly and still wonderful. And this was a great example of an episode of the original series that was just so much fun to watch. I also just got a chance to watch A Trouble with Tribbles, which is the definitive silly episode of Trek. And I really enjoyed that one as well.
Awesome. Well, Norm, where can we find you online?
I'm on Facebook at Norman Lau. And Twitter, the same name, Normanlao. I love it when Christopher spells out my name because he like punctuates the A. I'm a associate producer for three shows on Trek FM, Warp 5, The Orb, and Star Trek Axanar, the official Axanar podcast. And I'm on that forum all the time because I'm a huge supporter of Axanar and of Alec Peters. So you can find me on that forum probably every day, but not during work hours. So
shh, I won't tell anyone.
But Andy, I'm so excited. I think it would be great to follow you and hear all of your reports on watching Star Trek for the first time. That's mind-blowing.
I know.
The original series the first time. That's mind-blowing.
Yeah, and I started with the Next Generation, and people did not believe that I really had no idea about anything with Star Trek, other than like the most obvious kind of things that have like seeped into popular culture. I really had no idea what was coming, and let's just say people enjoy watching me be shocked.
It's awesome.
I'm excited for you. You have a lot of great stuff coming up.
Yeah, and
no kidding.
If you're interested too, I have been getting this question more often now that I'm pretty deep into the original series. I did also do the entirety of The Next Generation. And Twitter, as awesome as it is, does not have a really good function for going back and searching old tweets. So what I've been working on getting my old tweets onto Tumblr. So I am also on Tumblr as First Time Trek, and I'm collecting them by episode. So you can see the first maybe 10 episodes of The Next Generation I've collected. So if you want to go back and see that as well, I'm on Tumblr. I'm not good at Tumblr yet, but I'm working on it.
Well, guys, I'm so glad you got a chance to stop by the 602 Club, and we'll see y'all next time, and y'all come back now, you hear?